hope everyone can hear me fine.
We can't hear you too well, actually.
Okay. How is it now?
Better.
Better?
Go ahead.
Okay, is this good now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, hi, as Professor Pullin said, I am Fethi Ramazanoglu from Princeton University Physics Department. I'm a PhD student there. I'm going to present you information loss in the CGHS model. This is work in collaboration with Abhay Ashtekar from Penn State and my advisor, Franz Praetorius. So, for logistics of the talk, I have numbers of the presentation of the slide on each slide, and I won't delay all the questions to the end. You know, after certain parts of the talk, at certain parts of the presentation, you know, I will ask if anyone has questions to make things clear. Probably it will be easier to communicate that way. And if you have an immediate question, don't hesitate to ask. So let's start. Let's go to the first slide, the outline. I'll start with a quick overview of information loss in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and I will introduce the CGHS model, what it is. I will briefly talk on our numerical solution of the CGHS model. I'm not going into too many details, so I hope I won't bore you in that part. And I will present our main results for both the microscopic black holes and Planck scale black holes. Up until this point, my to the 10-minute talk I gave at the APS April meeting. Just before my conclusions, I will give some of our more recent results since my last talk. And in the end, I will give my conclusions and talk about our future direction. Okay, let's go to the next slide, slide number 3. Here's a quick overview of information loss. Basically, let's work on a 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time. So this is your Penrose diagram. Let's start with the fixed background Hawking operation case. So here you have your null infinity. This is a null coordinate system. On the right path null infinity, scry minus r, you start with some metric configuration. And on scry l minus, you start with the vacuum. So your matter falls in, it forms a black hole, you have a singularity, and then you want to see what happens to your vacuum state that started on IL minus. Thing is, IL minus is defined in such a way that you have an affine parameter, I will name it Z minus, on IL minus, and the annihilation operators associated with this Z minus annihilates this vacuum state. But when you look at this state, on the future null infinity, IR minus, and on IR minus, R like Rhode Island, you have another affine coordinate, which is Y minus, different from Z minus. And the annihilation operators associated with Y minus are also different from Z minus. Thus, this what used to be a vacuum state is not annihilated anymore on IR plus. So this is the basic Hawking operation case. If you start with a vacuum on the past, you end up with a non-vacuum in the future. This is one aspect of the Hawking operation. Another even maybe more interesting fact is that if you look at the last ray, so basically the ray from the first instance of the singularity that goes to IR plus, where last ray intersects IR plus, if you look at your affine coordinate Y minus, it reaches infinity. So in a sense, your whole space-time ends up where the last ray meets fusional infinity, IR plus. So that dashed region of the space-time is not really there at all. This is called, in that case, it's said that what you need to do is that, remember, in the past null infinity, IL minus, your vacuum was defined on the whole range. So you want to define your vacuum on the whole range of IR plus, including the dashed region. Since you are missing the dashed region, you basically trace out the states corresponding to those dashed region, and you end up with a mixed state instead of a pure state. That leads to a thermal evaporation, to a thermal state. So in the end, information is lost. Basically, you start a pure state, a vacuum, end up with some mixed state. So this is very curious. Let's go to the next slide, slide 4. But people think that this is probably an artifact of using this fixed background Hawking evaporation. If you had a full theory of quantum gravity, what you would have is that instead of a singularity, you would have some wild quantum behavior. But in the end, you wouldn't be missing that dashed region that you were missing in the fixed background case. You would have the full range of Scribe Plus. And in the end, there won't be any information loss. Once you start the vacuum, you end up with some other state maybe, but you won't have to trace over any degrees of freedom. So you can see that information loss, so starting with a pure state and going to a thermal state, is directly associated with the fact that your affine parameter y minus on Scribe Plus becomes infinite at a finite point in your fiducial space-time manifold. As I said, in quantum gravity, people think this problem is solved. In our talk, we will be interested in the middle ground, which is called the mean field approximation. In the mean field approximation, you count in the lower order corrections to your fixed background, but you still don't go up to the full quantum gravity. And there is a hope that maybe even at the mean field approximation level, without going to quantum gravity,
So it's now next transparency, right? Next slide.
Sorry, I forgot to mention that. Now in the next one, in the fifth slide, in the middle picture, you see the mean field approximation picture. We hope that even before going to the full quantum gravity case, you may actually have your full space-time background back, in the sense that your parameter, affine parameter y minus, will not become infinite when the last ray meets Scribe Plus, which indicates that still after the last ray, there is some space-time to continue, and the dash region is in fact a part of the space-time. It's not just some mathematical construct, and your state still stays pure because you don't have to trace over any missing part of the space-time. In our talk, the most basic problem would be trying to see whether the affine parameter y minus on Scribe Plus reaches a value of infinity at the last ray or not. And we will show that it does not reach a value of infinity. It stays finite at the last ray, which means there is still more space-time after the last ray. And this strongly indicates that there is not information loss in the CGHS model. Let's go to the next slide. Why the CGHS model? Why not the real 3 plus 1 dimensional Einstein space-time? Well, first of all, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, we have conformal flatness. Every metric is conformally related to the flattening coefficient, which makes many calculations very easy. For the MFA equations, the one-loop calculation is quite easy in 1 dimensions. You can use just the trace anomaly to calculate the one-loop correction, and this leads to a very sensible action. And when you do reduced 3 plus 1, the issue is a bit different. And it's harder to solve, actually. And a bonus for us numerics is that numerics are more manageable when you have only two dimensions rather than four. Other than that, also I will show that qualitatively, the CGHS model is very similar to the reduced 3 plus 1D case. So it's not exactly the same, but all the qualitative properties are very similar, yet it is analytically solvable, unlike the reduced 3 plus 1D dimensional case. So it also makes many things very, very much easier.
So by reduced 3 plus 1, you mean if you start in 3 plus 1 dimensions with spherical symmetry and reduce with respect to the spherical symmetry, right?
Exactly. Okay, thank you. To the next slide, please. Slide 7. So here, the upper action gives our CGHS action, and the lower action, the red one with S4, is basically the reduced spherical symmetric 3 plus 1 dimensional action, reduced to the 1 plus 1 dimension. So you can see that they are very similar, but let's talk on the CGHS action, the upper one. So you have your metric terms, you know, GAB, and you have R explicitly, the richest scalar in your metric. You have a Dilaton field, phi. You have some kind of a cosmological constant, kappa. And this metric is coupled to some massless matter fields, Fi, and you have N of them. Capital N will give us the number of matter fields in the CGHS model. So let's go to the next slide. We'll slightly change our variables. Instead of using the Dilaton lowercase phi, we will use the capital phi, which is e to the minus 2 phi. And from now on, I'll refer to this capital phi sometimes as phi. So if I just say phi from now on, I will mean the capital phi, unless I specify otherwise. And we also introduce this conformal factor using theta and phi as well. So if you derive the equations of motion, you basically will have two sets of equations. So the middle three equations, the middle three black equations, are the evolution equations. And the last two bottom equations are called the constraint equations, because basically if you import the constraint equations, the last two equations, in the boundaries, then the middle evolution equations naturally evolve those constraints throughout your region. The variables we use, the capital phi and the capital theta, were introduced, at least to our knowledge, in the Ashtaka-Tavaras-Varadarajan paper of 2008, which we will frequently reference. Let's go to the next slide. So we simplify our constants a bit. We pick H bar and C to be equal to 1. We choose G and kappa to be 1. This is different from just using some Planck units. I will comment more on that later. But let me go to the first, the most basic black hole solution in the CGHS model, the eternal black hole. So in the eternal black hole, you have no matter fields at all, and you can show that, in fact, there is a solution of black hole in the CGHS model. You can do this calculation analytically. It's given by this phi and theta, but solution is not very interesting for our talk right now. So this was the way. So in the CGHS model, you can have an eternal black hole. Let's go to the next slide, slide 10. The first interesting solution for us is the classical collapsing shell. So let's say in the cry minus past null infinity, we start with a matter profile which is a delta function at a specific point. For this case, I fix a point to be zero. So it's just a single delta wave. You have incoming matter at a single point, at a single value of z plus, and you have no matter anywhere else. And if you go through the solution of this problem, and you can see that it is analytically solvable, you will see that before you come to the matter wave, F wave, you have the Dilaton vacuum I was talking about in the previous slide. So there is nothing interesting going on. But after you hit the matter wave, basically, you will have a different solution for phi. And if you look at what happens, you will see that as singularity forms, you will have trapped points, you will have a horizon. So all the basics of a black hole you would see in a classical collapsing shell in the CGHS model. So this is the part where they say it's very similar to the 3 plus 1 decay. Let's go to the next slide. What can you do with the classical collapsing shell? You can calculate the forcing radiation with it. So using the trace anomaly, you can show that the trace of the stress energy tensor is directly related to the Ricci scalar in 1 plus 1 dimension. Okay, there are a few typos in this slide, so I will try to correct them. So remember, the first thing we were interested in was the asymptotic affine coordinate y minus finite at the last ray or not. If you look at the third equation, e to the minus kappa y minus equals e to the minus blah blah equation, that is the equation that gives us whether y minus is finite or not at the last ray. So there is a typo there, of course. It should be e to the minus kappa y minus equals e to the minus kappa z minus minus m. when you change the second y minus with z minus, you can very quickly see that at a finite value of z minus, y, which is the value where you, the last ray hits the crypt minus, y minus reaches a value of infinity. In the next line, you can see that there is another typo in the next line. I'm sorry for this slide. There are quite a few typos. So y minus, minus at zs by zs minus, I mean the point where the singularity, sorry, where the last ray hits y minus. So at the last ray, y minus reaches infinite. And the typo there, because I say zs minus, you know, the last ray, the coordinate of the last ray is infinite, but it's not infinite. So that's the whole point, basically. Whereas zs minus is finite, y minus reaches the value of infinity, if you look at the functional form. And for our future reference, it's useful to look at how y minus diverges near the last ray. If you look at dy minus over dz minus, you can see that it is a power law with a power of minus 1. So if you are a distance delta z away from the last ray, then the derivative of y minus with respect to z minus will go like 1 over that distance to the last ray. So you have a logarithmic divergence. And this will be useful in our establishing the case for the finiteness of y minus in the mean field approximation. So to summarize this slide, in a classical collapsing shell, if you look at the equations, you see that y minus reaches a value of infinity at the point where the last ray intersects with which are now infinite, IR plus, scry plus, sorry, scry minus. So this is exactly the same picture you would have for the external field of Hawking radiation in the regular case. So with your space-time ends, you have to trace over the missing piece of the space-time, and information is indeed still lost if you have this external field approximation. Next slide, please. If you look at the Hawking radiation itself, so you can forget about the x-axis. It's just some compactified axis. The leftmost of the leftmost point on the x is minus infinity. You start from minus infinity, and the right and the rightmost point is the future is the last ray. If you look at your Hawking radiation in the external field approximation, the Hawking radiation starts from zero, goes up, 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 and then approaches a constant value asymptotically and stays constant. Even though I compactified the coordinate, again, I should emphasize this point, this has an infinite range. So for an infinite amount of time, in a sense, you will have a constant radiation, which will be given by n over 48, if you look at the formula on the title of the slide. So you will radiate away an infinite amount of energy, which is not physical, but which happens when you use a fixed background, of course. The next slide, please. So here are our mean field approximation equations. These are basically what we work on. Again, you use a trace anomaly. Again, remember, you had previously these equations where T plus minus equals zero, but if you use a trace anomaly, you can see that they won't be zero anymore. So at the first order of the mean field approximation, you can see you have these terms proportional to n as some sort of first terms in your evolution equations of the EJHS field. The equation for the method field won't change, but the equation for theta and phi will change. And if you look at the qualitative behavior, you can see that most of the things are very similar. Again, in singularity forms, again, you have trapped surfaces. It's not exactly the same, but you have the trapped surface and singularity and then apparent horizon, etc. And you have a Dilthin vacuum before hitting the matter field wave. Let's go to the next slide, please, slide 14. The most important part of the space-time is the time close to scry plus, the future null infinity. It turns out that you can have an asymptotic expansion for phi and theta in this case. And moreover, you can relate your affine parameter on scry plus, y minus, to the asymptotic behavior of phi on near Sukhoi class with the third equation given in this case. So if you have an asymptotic expansion, you have this leading term A for phi, and then your affine coordinate y minus is related to A in this case. And the first question we want to address is this y minus finite or not? So basically, you have constraint equations, you have evolution equations, you can numerically solve for phi and theta. Once you numerically solve for them, you can get the behavior in Neil's scribe plus, you can extract those A's, B's, A bars, B bars, etc. And from those, you can calculate many different quantities, of which the first one is y minus. You can calculate through A. Once you calculate y minus, you may try to see whether it's finite or not, and you will see that it is finite again. And this expansion is again also taken from ATV paper. Let's go to the next slide. Of course, that's it. The first question we want to address is the finiteness of y minus, but it is not the only question we want to address. We want to see how the energy flux on IR plus behaves. Is it like the external field case or not? We want to see the area of the black hole on the apparent horizon, how it behaves, etc., etc. And one very useful equation for this case is the energy balance equation you have here, the big equation. So this equation was again obtained in the ATV paper. So you see, we call this the energy balance equation because it is these two natural pieces. It's basically, you can mathematically just obtain this equation if you play with the asymptotic behavior of phi and theta, but it's more than just using some certain coordinates to get some random equation. So you have a full derivative of a quantity, which I call MB, and I will claim it's the Bondi mass. And then on the other side of the equation, on the second line, you have a positive definite term, which ATV identified with the MFA energy flux on Sukhoi plus. And this is a very natural identification lesson. So you can arrange basically the both terms in this equation if you want to. You know, you can move some piece of the MFA flux to the other side of the equation, but this way of arranging it is very natural because you have a positive definite term for the flux. And moreover, I should note that I said I call the term on the first line whose derivative is taken to be the Bondi mass. That's not something that has been in the literature throughout time. In fact, in most of the literature, people use the first two terms only, dB over dy plus kappa b, to be the Bondi mass. We call those two terms to be the Heywood mass, and we claim you need a third correction, and we'll come to that. And in the upcoming slide, basically, it's important to have that third term because if you look at the literature, many people claim that what they call Bondi mass, just the first two terms, would go to zero at the last ray. Or people would sometimes, even people who solve the equations numerically, would say that they see those first two terms go to negative values, which is unphysical, so no approximations break down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, if you look, when we look at our version of the Bondi mass, you can see that it doesn't go to negative values. And indeed, if you just keep the first two terms, which is not very correct to do, it indeed goes down to negative values. And it's not because there is, not necessarily because there is something unphysical happening there, but just because you are not looking at the correct expression for the Bondi mass. Anyway, and the next thing we are interested in is the area, which is given by the capital phi minus n over 12, calculated on the apparent horizon. So if you calculate this quantity on the apparent horizon, for each z minus value, you can assign an area to the black hole. And this also has another important property that even though for the mean field approximation case, the equations are not solvable analytically. That's why we came in and tried to solve them numerically. Analytically, we know that at the singularity, capital phi goes to n over 12. So this thing we call area indeed goes to zero exactly in the mean field approximation at the singularity. You know that. Please go to next slide, 16. Just a few remarks. I should say that in the literature also you will see here things about the semi-classical case being satisfied when n is much greater than 1, etc., etc. But this is also not very accurate, because if you look at the structure of the equations, what matters is m over n. And by m, I mean the initial value of the mass you send in. So initial, the initial mass you have in the past infinity. So basically, if you just look at the mathematical formulation of the model, you can see that if you start with phi, theta, and f, if you scale phi, theta, and n by alpha, and that's equivalent to scaling both m and n, the mass and the number of fields by alpha, and if you keep the shapes of the field, matter field f constant, then basically you have pretty much the same solution. Some of the quantities are adjusted, but those changes are analytical. So in the end, if you just change m and n by the same constant alpha, it won't change your evolution. So the basic thing that matters is m over n. So you can always normalize with n if you use some random n. And in the upcoming figures, we use the value of n equals 24 for our calculations. A second issue is, I mentioned this briefly beforehand, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, unlike 3 plus 1, g times h bar is dimensionless. So it's just a Planck number. So you can basically randomly throw in any power of g plus h bar to any kind of unit you want to have. For that reason, it's not a trivial choice. You can't really choose a Planck mass directly. So you can't really set a Planck mass just by adjusting your unit. You have to choose a value for g. So it's different from a 3 plus 1 dimensional case. And we chose g to be 1 as well. And we also chose kappa to be 1 for all our expressions, for all the upcoming expressions. And choosing kappa equals 1 sets that length scale of 1, and choosing g with that one, choosing g equals 1, that's a mass scale of 1 as well. Okay, let's go to... okay, at this point, I should say, does anyone have any questions? So this is the point where we finish our introduction of the CGHS model. It was long maybe for the introduction, but I want to make sure everyone is on the same page here. So any questions about the CGHS model? Or anything else I mentioned so far?
So I had a question. If we go back to slide 15, what is the issue with the bonding mass exactly? Why is there controversy?
Well, I think the controversy really. The thing is that you cannot. So you have this equation. Basically, you can move everything to one side, and you can say this very equation. This equation is obtained in the TAV paper I mentioned before, and you can just. The thing is that in previously. Even so, this equation is obtained from the evolution and constraints, etc., of the CGHS model itself. If you work out the asymptotic behavior, you get this equation. But in the literature, there is already a formula for the bonding mass in systems like the CGHS model, without looking at asymptotic behavior, etc., anything. And that equation only contains the first two terms of MB. So there is this common belief that the mass is given by dB over dy plus kappa b, without even looking at the, looking at the behavior of the fields in the CGHS model. And people use those first two terms, dB over dy plus kappa b, as the mass. And they have reported different results from that. They said mass goes down to negative values, and they have the expectation that mass goes down to value of, should go down to value of zero in the, if things work out right, et cetera, et cetera. But Ashtekar et al. Did was, if you actually look at the equations in the CGHS model, you come up with this equation, just from the equation. And if you arrange it in this term, there is a natural assignment of MB with a third term, which has this NGH power of 24. And in our simulations, we also saw that this value is the correct value, in fact, to assign with the bonding mass, because this thing is always positive in our simulations. It never goes down to negative values, and it goes down to a value of a single Planck mass at the last ray, which is expected. And we also checked what happens to the Hayward mass, the first two terms, dV over dy plus kappa b, and it indeed goes to negative values, and not just small negative values, quite big negative values for some parameters, for some initial parameters. So I think this is a non-trivial thing that MBV, the equation we use for the boundary mass is all these C terms, but not just the two terms that has been used in the literature. Is that clear?
So essentially this...
I can add a few words because of the audience, relative to the audience. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't think I'm saying anything new, but I mean, it's really what Fethi said, but just slightly different words. You know, when in four dimensions, when Bondi first obtained the Bondi mass, right? So there, people probably remember that is in static space times, the mass aspect is, or the thing that you integrate over the two spheres, is just given by psi 2 zero, right? The psi 2 component of the wild tensor. Now the question is, what should the mass be in a general dynamic space-time? Now somebody might say that, well, the mass should just be psi 2 itself. And in fact, historically, that's what Ted Newman did. But if you did that, if you define mass to be just psi 2, then the asymptotic field equations imply that the flux of energy across cry can be both positive and negative. And one of Bondi's key achievements was to say that, no, mass is not given by psi 2. In static space-time, it is just psi 2. But in dynamical space-time, it should be psi 2 plus shear dot, or shear times nu. Right? And if you do that, then the rate of change of this quantity on the right-hand side is just given by just the square of sigma dots, and therefore it is positive definite. So he changed the notion of, he realized that one has to change the notion of mass in going from static to dynamical space-times in order that the Bondi nu, so to say, the flux of radiated energy is actually positive. Now in the literature in CGHS model, one can again obtain an identity just like what Newman and Bondi and other people had obtained. And the question is, which term should we think of as mass and which terms one should think of as being flux? And, you know, the particle physics literature, starting with Suskind et al. And then also Hayward and so on, they just took what Fethi is saying, the first two terms, namely dB by dy minus plus kappa times b as the mass. And this was correct in the static space times. That the solutions that people had actually obtained before, this was correct. And so they use the same definition. But if you use that definition, then in fact the flux at infinity is not positive definite. Basically what you're doing is, you're taking the third term on the left-hand side of the big equation and moving it to the right-hand side. And then the right-hand side does not have a definite sign. If on the other hand, you say that the mass is given by not only the first two terms, which are there in the static case, but it acquires a quantum correction, which is ngh bar upon 24 times that term. And then that the sum of those three terms is what you should call Bondi mass, then the rate of change of this, the flux of this, turns out to be completely positive definite just by inspection, as Fethi has just remarked up here. So that's why we suggested that we should do this reinterpretation. And then it has some other consequences when you come to talking about information loss and so on. But surprisingly, in these numerical evolutions, Fethi and Franz have found that if you use the old definition, just the first two terms, which Fethi is calling Hayward mass in the subsequent transparencies, then that mass actually can become large and negative on scry minus. Whereas in the literature, people implicitly always argued that that mass was positive and went to zero. So in the literature, there is a clear big mistake in the whole intuition that people have had. The quantity they thought represented mass, and they thought that it was always positive and just went to zero as the black hole evaporated away, that Fethi's and Franz's simulation show, in fact, become large and negative. So there's a complete independent reason to think that the first three terms should be thought of as a mass. As Fethi will say, if you do this, then in fact, the mass does remain positive and has nice properties further on. Is this okay, Jorge?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to the next part of talk, so slide 17. Let's talk briefly on our numerical solutions, and I promise I'll be brief. We did many things to the original equations. First, we regularized them because asymptotically they go to infinite on the boundaries. We had this phi tilde and theta tilde, and we use some scaled, we of course compactified the coordinates. As you said, there are also some typos in there. For example, in the third line of the Z plus, I say Z plus is in the range of 0, 1 half, and then second thing should be ZC minus is in the range of 0, 1. I will correct these, hopefully, and the updated slides will be on after the talk. But the details aren't very important. The important thing is that we did the compactification such that the region near last ray is emphasized. Most of our grid spacing is assigned to the region very near the last ray, and we didn't put that much emphasis on the region far away from the last ray. And we use a unigrid mesh. Our mesh isn't adapting. So in a sense, this the way we compactify adapt the mesh, in a sense. Also discretize the equations, decast them into a polynomial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not very important. The next slide, please. So slide 18, the lesson to take is, and we did all these so that we can have very high resolution near the last ray. And very small truncation errors for the field variables. And we achieved them, but it wasn't very easy to do. And it is very important to have this, especially for the classical case, if you start with a macroscopic black hole. Because most of the evolution occurs very close to the last ray. Until you get very close to last, and by very close, you can set, I said, by setting kappa equals 1, you set length scale of 1. So unless you get to a distance much, much smaller than 1 to the last ray, you won't see many of the important features of the model. You won't see mass evaporate down. You will see mass goes down a bit, then it's stuck there. You say, oh, okay, maybe the mass isn't visually evaded, et cetera, at the last ray, but it may be just the case that you are not close enough to the singularity. So you have to make sure you are close enough to the singularity, say that, you know, you are close enough to the last ray to say that, okay, at the last ray, this happens. And but one of the main things we tried to establish that we made sure we are really close to last ray, and our results really correspond to the results what one would see at the last ray. That's it for the numerics. Any questions about the numerics? Anything you wonder, anyone?
I should just add one. I think Fethi is, and Franz are being very modest here. I think this was incredibly numerically challenging problem. In the near the last ray, in the some of the simulations that we will see, they had to increase the resolution by a factor of 10 to the 16 in order to see the radiation actually occurring and the interesting features actually occurring. So there is a big blow up basically between the physical Y coordinate and the background Z coordinates that one has near sky. I should be more precise, Y minus and Z minus that you have on right sky plus. And it is because of this that of large physical distances at sky plus are cramped into small ranges of the Z coordinate in which the initial calculations were done. And therefore, to see physical effects, one had to magnify it, and as I said, the magnifying glass had to have a factor of 10 to the 16 or so. And this was incredibly numerically challenging. And this is the reason why, in the last 20 years, people who had done CGHS model also numerically had not seen all these wonderful results that Fethi is about to show us.
Thanks, Professor Ashtaka, for the compliments. Okay, let's go to slide 19. Okay, here finally our results. So this is the first result. I start with a macroscopic black hole, and in this case, by macroscopic, I mean the initial mass is 16.6 Planck masses, in a sense. So this is a plot of the asymptotic, the affine coordinate y minus. So the thing that we want to see whether it's finite or not. On the x-axis, you have a compactified version of z minus. Basically, the leftmost is past infinity, and the dashed red line on the right, very close to the rightmost of the plot, that is the last ray. And this is a plot of y minus. Basically, at the past infinity, it starts from minus infinity, it rises up, and you see that near the last ray, it's increasing and increasing. And you can see that it is finite. Well, now I say you can see that it is finite. Of course, many of you see that there is a gap between the end of my plot and the red dashed line, which I say is the last ray. So I am not quite on the last ray. And numerically, you can't be exactly on the last ray, of course. And some of you may say, okay, you see a finite value, but I see that y minus is really increasing fast. So maybe you are just missing that last little piece, and you know, in that last little piece, y minus would just blow away and become infinite. So you can't just say, tell me that y minus stays finite in this case. Well, in the APS meeting talk, I just said you should take my word for it, and we really checked it. So here is how we really checked it. First, let's go back to slide. Where was it? 11, please, if it's not hard for you.
Sorry, which slide?
11. 1-1. Maybe I should have inserted it here. Sorry for that. So remember that this is the external field case. I told you that in this case, y minus is indeed infinite at the last ray. And one way to see it was that dy over dz goes like 1 over the distance from the last ray. So there's an inverse power law with power of minus, there's a power law with power minus 1, which means there's a logarithmic derivative, the logarithmic divergence. So consequently, you can see that if dy over dz behaves with another power, dy over dz behaves like the distance from the last ray to the power to some power greater than minus 1, then you can see that the integral of dy over dz would be finite. So by looking at the power law behavior of dy over dz, you can actually establish whether y will remain finite or not at the last ray. And it will be infinite if that the power law is such that the power is less than minus 1, and it will be finite if it is greater than minus 1. So if we can go back to slide 20 now. On slide 20, there are a lot of things on the axis. You can forget about them. Basically, what this slide shows is the power law behavior of dy over dz near the last ray. So near the last ray, you can see, a bit away from the last ray, the power law is minus 1, which confirms the similarity to the Hawking. I should mention this. This axis is a bit different from the previous one. So on the leftmost, you are at the last ray. The leftmost part of the value has minus 36 for the logarithmic value. That is the last ray. This is close to the last ray. And as you go to the right, you are getting away from the last ray. Sorry for that graph is a bit inverted. So away from the last ray, in the right hand of the plot, you can see that the power law of dy over dz is approaching minus 1, that logarithmic divergence. But as you get closer to the last ray, you can see that the dy over dz has a higher and higher power, and the power approaches 0, which means that its integral will not go up. In fact, this was the first test we really tried to establish that y minus is finite. It's not just the fact that within our simulation, y doesn't blow up or simulation breaks down or something. We actually looked at the functional behavior of y minus to see whether its trend is going towards infinity or not. And this was basically how we did it. Is there any question about this slide from anyone? No. Okay, good. The conclusion is that y minus within the bounds of our simulation remains finite at the last ray in the mean field approximation level. This is a very strong indication that space-time hasn't ended and information is not lost. It doesn't prove information is not lost because you need some more things to show that. But at least we, I think, securely established that y minus stays finite at the last ray, at the mean field approximation level in the CGHS model. Let's go to the next slide now, slide 21. That was y minus. Let's look at what happens to the mass, the Bondi mass. So you start with an initial mass. As I said, this is the macroscopic black hole. I start with 16.6. Okay, I don't start with 100 because it's still hard. It gets harder and harder as you increase your initial mass, but this is quite macroscopic, I would say. So your mass goes down as you see. Okay, again, this is not the in this process such that zero is past infinity and the red dashed line is your last rate. So you start with the macroscopic mass, it evaporates, and it goes down to a mass of order 1, in this case, you will see. And even though it's not, you can't, there's a gap in this plot as well, between the end of the plot and the last ray, I should say that we see that the mass remains non-zero, it's greater than zero. It's always positive, it never becomes non-zero, it never becomes negative, and it it doesn't go to zero either, and I will show you why we think it doesn't go to zero either. It's not just numeric, but we established it doesn't go to zero. Next slide, please. 22. So here is the MFA energy flux. On the title, I say Hawking radiation. I should have avoided from using that. Professor Ashtekar is always very careful with notation. So this is not Hawking radiation. This is the MFA energy flux. This is not the external approximation. This is what we have in the MFA from the MFA equations. So for reference, I have the horizontal purple dashed line, which gives you the plateau value of the Hawking radiation you would have if you use the external field approximation. Again, the red line is the last ray. You start from minus infinity. So your energy flux starts from zero. It rises up, is in some kind of a plateau, and near the last ray, it's increasing very fast. And you can see that even far before the last ray, when everything is macroscopic, the energy flux is significantly different from what you would have as the plateau value of the Hawking radiation in the external field approximation. And this is an indication that this is not as the case, the thermal case of the Hawking radiation. So this is different, significantly different from the Hawking radiation. And as you go closer and closer to the last ray, you can see that the difference is even bigger. The MFA flux isn't decaying down to zero as the mass most has operated, but it's just getting bigger and bigger. The next slide, please. Here we look at the area maturation, again, of the macroscopic black hole, and you can see that at first they are almost equal. But, okay, again, on the left side we have minus infinity and the red dashed line is the last ray. Here I'm looking at the ratio of area and mass, and remember, area exactly goes to zero at the last ray. So you can see that as you approach the singularity, the last ray, the area over mass is becoming smaller and smaller, indicating that even though area is going to zero, the mass is not going to zero. Of course, you can say they are both going to zero, but with different mathematical behavior, but I will show you another plot where I think it's quite clear that the mass isn't really going to zero. It's staying finite, and so it's staying positive while area is approaching zero. The next slide, please. Now, here is the case with the Planck scale mass black hole. The previous results were for a macroscopic black hole, in a sense. With the Planck scale, by Planck scale, I have an initial mass of 0.05. Here is y minus, the same deal again, and you can see here there isn't even a divergent behavior. I won't show you how we establish behavior here, but again, you can, if you check the approach to the last ray, you can see that y minus is indeed finite at the last ray for the Planck scale black hole as well. It's up Planck scale black hole. The next slide, please, slide 25. If you look at the bonding mass, one interesting feature is it doesn't really evaporate away much. If you start from already at sub Planck scale 0.05, there isn't any lower scale you can evaporate into. So it almost stays the same. It evaporates a bit of the mass, but just stays close to its initial value. Next slide, please. If you look at the Hawking radiation.
But in this last transparency, the body mass is not changing much, but the area is actually going to zero. The area of the horizon is going to zero, even though the body mass is not changing much. That's the key point, right?
Yes, yes. I should say that the area is always, analytically, you can show that area goes, by this definition, goes to zero at the last ray. Yes. And I won't show you the area graph, but yes, even though area goes to zero, that's how we established that. We reached the last ray, in fact. We are close to the last ray. But even the area goes to zero, the bonding mass stays which cross initial value. Yeah, thanks for the warning, Professor. Next slide, please. The Hawking radiation. Sorry, I shouldn't call this the Hawking radiation again. This is the MFA energy flux. This is not an external field approximation. Again, we are in the MFA regime, the MFA approximation. So again, you start from a zero energy flux on the region of infinity. It rises up, but unlike the previous case, there is no plateau-like behavior. So it's just increasing as you get close to the last ray. And this is very, very different. I mean, even the Bakusubik case is very different, quite different from the external field approximation case, the Hawking radiation. And the Planck-scale black hole case is radically different from the external field approximation case. Very quickly, okay, next please, the slide 27. Here is just an example case. So I call this M. Hayward. Again, I remind you, we have those three terms in the valence equation we had previously. If you just keep the two terms, first two terms, I call this the Hayward mass. But it's just what I call it. And I remember I told you that it goes down to negative values. Here is what happens for an initial mass of 10. If you start, your Hayward mass would cross the value of zero as you approach the last ray. Here I don't show the dashed line, but again, the last ray is near Zc minus equals 1. So your Hayward mass becomes negative, and not just small negative values, it gets quite big, I would say. And it's similar for all the values in between the macroscopic and the microscopic black hole I mentioned beforehand. I don't show you the intermediate values, but all the behavior is similar for those. Next slide, please. Okay, here is what I call the universal curve. This is a curve of A versus M. So the area, on the y-axis I have the difference of area and the bonding mass, but okay, it represents the bonding mass. And on the x-axis I have the area using the function I mentioned before. On this plot, what you have is I start with different initial masses, you know, for 18, 14, 12, 10, 8, and plot this A minus M 1D versus A for all these different masses on the same plot. What you see is that if you start with 18, you trace out a certain curve on this plane, M versus A plane. If you start with 14, you trace out another curve with 12, 10, 8. Even though you are decreasing the mass from 18 to 8, almost all of them trace out the same curve, in a sense. This shows that, basically, for example, this indication that if you start with a mass of 100, for example, probably you can see that there is this tail in the past. When your area is big in the past, probably it will be a bit different, but if you start with a mass of 100, if you wait down, when it gets down to a mass of 10, it would also be on this curve. So this curve is, in some sense, universal. It doesn't really matter whether you start a mass of 18 and then drop down to 10 and trace what happens after the mass drops down to 10. We just initially start with a mass of 10 and try to see, you know, what happens in the end. I think this behavior could be used to establish a behavior such that you don't really have to go to the mass of thousands and 10,000. Of course, this is just one aspect of the behavior of the mass, not everything you have, but it's an indication that starting from a mass of 100 isn't that much different from starting from a mass of 10, in a sense, if you are interested in what happens close to the last ray. Okay, my next plot. Here is a plot of a very rough plot of what happens to the mass at the last ray. So on the x-axis you have the initial mass, z minus q minus infinity, your initial bonding mass you start with, and on the y-axis you have the bonding mass you have at the last ray. So you evaporate. So remember, when your initial mass is macroscopic, I said at the last ray you end up with a mass of one Planck mass. So here you can see the value is something like 0.86, 0.87. So if you, for high values of capital M star, there's this plateau behavior. You end up, at the last ray, you end up with a mass of 0.87, something of order 1. But if you have a sub-Planck scale mass, so all these values near 0, you pretty much end up with your initial mass. So the graph is linear, even though you can't see it very well here. This fit is something random, I would say. I haven't been able to find a very good functional fit to this plot, but it clearly establishes the behavior. So as you increase your initial mass more and more and more, in the end, you will always end up with some universal mass at the last rate, which is at the order of one Planck mass. It doesn't really matter if you have a huge mass in the beginning. So that's the expected behavior, and this shows you the whole range of parameters, not just one macroscopic and one microscopic black hole. So I think this is another clear indication that our mass definition makes good sense. My conclusions, the last slide 30. The first thing we were after establishing whether y minus is finite with the mean field approximation, and it is indeed finite in the mean field approximation, which is a strong evidence for the unitarity. We have shown that for all macroscopic black holes, bonding mass at the last rate is at the order of unity, and if the initial mass itself is a order of Planck mass or sub-Planck mass, we show that there is little change in the mass, there is little evaporation, and the evaporation process itself is very different from the external field picture. So the MFA flux plot was very different from the Hawking radiation flux. And I should emphasize again that you need very high resolution numerics near the singularity with very low truncation errors to be able to see many of these phenomena, especially for the for the macroscopic black hole. You wouldn't be able to get close enough to see most of these behaviors if you weren't careful about your numerics. For future directions, and these are with Amos Ory, we want to see the behavior of the flux near the last ray. So I showed that the behavior of the MFA flux is increasing near the last ray. How is it increasing? Is it going to infinite or not? We want to see it more clearly. We want to compare our numerical results to more detailed analytical results, even though the equation can't be solved exactly analytically. Amos Ory has some approximate analytical solutions that we can check our numerical results in a better sense. And lastly, we want to see what happens beyond the singularity. Can we extend the solution in some sense beyond the singularity and the last ray and see what happens in that regime of the space-time? Thank you for listening to me. If you have any questions, I can take them now.
Questions? Well, so I have a question then. So can we go back to slide, I think it's 22.
Okay.
I assume that the purple sort of dashed line is a calculation of the radiation in the background, fixed background case?
Exactly, yes.
Now, intuitively, one would expect that calculation to approximate the blue curve somewhere for a little while. Is there any simple understanding as to why it gets it wrong all the time?
One thing is, I think, is a strong indication that the evaporation isn't... Hello?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. This is a strong indication that, in fact, even when you have a macroscopic mass, things are different from the fixed background. And it shows that things aren't really, really thermal. I haven't shown you the plot, but so far the only approximation of Amos Ory we have compared our results to is, in fact, this exact same plot. He has an equation for the MFA energy flux in terms of a linear term in the bonding mass. And when we compared our results, there was an unbelievably accurate match between the two. So we are very confident about the difference from the plateau value of the Hawking radiation. And why it happens, I think this is a clear indication that even when you are away from the singularity for initially macroscopic black holes, things aren't very classical in a sense. You have strong quantum effects and not a thermal radiation in the end.
And if you start with a larger initial mass, do these curves get closer somehow, or?
It very much get closer. I think there's an indication that yes, that plateau regime becomes bigger in the Z. So there's these values of Zc minus where you have the rise and the plateau and the final rise. That plateau regime can get wider as you increase the classical solution, but. And I should say the numerics gets harder and harder if you go to higher initial masses. So we haven't really gone much higher than this case. This is 16.6 initial mass. We went up to 20, but not definitely to 100. I don't know what will happen to the distance between the two plateaus, plateau of the MFA flux and the Hawking radiation. It might get small, but I still suspect it will be. A big difference. If I remember the Amasori's formula right, yes, they will get a bit closer, but the difference would still be visible and important.
Thank you.
So maybe I should add a little bit here. So the purple line, which is supposed to be the constant flux, that is really obtained in the mean field, in the external field approximation at late times, right? In other words, there is actually, in the very early times, in the external field approximation, the flux is zero, and then it rises very steeply, and then asymptotes to a constant value. So I think if you're doing the external field approximation, then roughly somewhere in the middle of the graph, namely somewhere between 0.4 and 0.5, is where the external field approximation would have reached its asymptotic value. Before that, the external field approximation also has not reached that asymptotic value. And the statement is that already during this time, the back reaction effects accumulate enough in order to give a deviation from the external field approximation. So what I'm saying is that to the left of 0.4 or 0.5, anyway, the pink line has not been achieved in the external field approximation. You're not reached a constant flux there. But here, one sees that once the back reaction is taken into account according to the mean field equations, then there is a deviation from the external field approximation already, you know, at this stage around starting already from, the meaningful comparison would be from 0.4 onwards, then there is a deviation there. So a couple of points that I want to make in addition. Okay, so conceptually what people have always argued for 20 years is that information is indeed lost in the evaporation of the CGHS black hole. And they make the following assumptions. Assumption one, that the area of the horizon goes to zero, and this was kind of numerically checked by Piran and Strominger and by David Lowe and other people. The assumption two, when the area goes to zero, the body mass goes to zero. Assumption three, throughout this process, a quasi-static approximation holds. And then the idea is that if the quasi-static approximation holds, then so to say, in each epoch where the evaporation is quasi-static, the evaporation is by a quasi-static black hole, it is approximately is essentially thermal, and therefore for a long duration, you have lost correlations, which you cannot hope to regain in the last sort of the burst when the mass is about a Planck mass, where there will be deviations to this quasi-static approximation. Now, the numerical work has shown that many of these assumptions are incorrect. The first idea that the horizon area goes to zero is indeed correct. But the second idea, that the body mass then goes to zero, turned out to be incorrect using the body mass that they were using. That body mass, the traditional body mass, actually goes to, becomes negative, and therefore the whole idea there was not right. But furthermore, what is interesting here is that once one realizes, which somehow was not actively realized, that what is important is not, so to say, the ADM mass, big M, but really the ratio of the ADM mass to the number of matter fields. The number of matter fields is like number of channels through which the black hole can evaporate. And amazingly, the exact equations, quantum equations, as well as the mean field approximation equations, have this nice symmetry, which also tell us that what is relevant is really M or N ratio. And this is what Fethi has been calling M star. Now, if you say that this is what is relevant, then one can ask, what happens at the end of evaporation? And using the definition of the bonding mass that we have, it turns out that this M star goes to approximately 1.87 Planck mass. That is to say, there's about 0.87 Planck mass left in the at null infinity in each of the N channels that we have. Now, one might say that, well, okay, then this is still a very small mass, and how are you going to recover the information? Because if you believe the traditional argument, the information is lost through each channel for a very, very long time. You've got a thermal radiation in each channel for a very, very long time. And then how can you recover it with such a small energy? At the end, the energy per channel is of the order of one Planck mass again. Well, that is again where this slide 22 is important, because as Jorge pointed out, there is in fact a deviation from the external field approximation. And this deviation from the external field approximation is twofold. One, the curves don't match. But more importantly, in the external field approximation, in the CGHS case, the flux, asymptotic flux, if the radiation were really thermal, one can show that in two dimensions, the flux is just constant. That's not what happens in four, in the higher dimensions, but in two dimensions, the flux is just constant. It does not depend on the mass of the remnant black hole, so to say, remaining mass in the black hole, it's just constant. So if the flux is not constant, it means it's a proof, not even an indication, but a proof that the radiation was not really entirely thermal. It might have been approximately thermal, but not entirely thermal. So this, if you look closely enough, you will see that this blue curve on slide 26 is actually, even in the plateau region, is actually rising slightly, which means that even throughout this region, there is really a large deviation, there is a small deviation from the thermal flux. So this is showing us that, in fact, the thermal flux was never really, the flux was never really thermal. And therefore, it's not true that the correlations are all lost during all this time. Of course, these are all just indications. But then the last point that Fethi made first, in fact, is that if the correlations were lost, and if, in fact, there was some leftover entropy, that would really occur if y minus, the coordinate y minus, which is the asymptotic killing coordinate in the physical space-time, dynamical space-time, if that went to infinity, then we would be really stuck, because then it would say that the indications from the external potential approximation were correct. But, in fact, y minus goes to a constant value. So the numerics is really done only in the mean field approximation, but it sort of gives credence, strong support, to all the ingredients in the ATV scenario in quantum theory, namely that at the end of this process at which the energy has shrunk to zero, at the end of this process, it is not true that, in fact, you have got a hugely mixed state. And secondly, that y minus there is really finite, therefore, the physical space-time actually extends beyond that. Putting these in, so this is really not a proof of the ATV scenario, because the proof can only come from fully quantum calculations, but this goes a long way to supporting that scenario much further than I had actually initially thought. And lastly, these numerical simulations have opened up a completely new door, which is this thing that Fethi showed in his last two transparencies. There seems to be some universal behavior there. I mean, the leftover mass in the transparency 28, for example, the A minus MB, there seems to be kind of a universal behavior once the area is shrunk to 4 Planck units. After that, all the macroscopic black holes seem to behave in exactly the same way. And this is something that was not expected before,
And therefore, there is something very interesting happening analytically here, which might, there might be a solution, like the critical solution of chopped wicks obtained in completely different contexts, which is actually being asymptotically approached. And also transparency 29, where one sees that, in fact, for large black holes, there seems to be a universal kind of remnant that is left over. This is also something that, you know, had there was no clear analytical, there were rough analytical reasons to believe this, but there was no clear analytical reason to sort of get this value 0.87, if you like. And that is also some very nice challenge to analytical calculations as to why this is happening. Yeah, these are the remarks I wanted to make.
Thanks, Professor.
More questions?
I have a question on slide 22. Can you clarify again why the flux isn't shutting off in the future?
What again?
Well, the flux is increasing here, and can you clarify why doesn't it shut off?
Oh, we don't know why it doesn't shut off, but even from the mathematical case, so if you look at, remember the power law behavior. If dy over dz behaves like 1 over distance from the last ray, y diverges. And if you go back and look at the MFA energy flux equations, you can see that the MFA energy flux also diverges in that case. But we said that if dy over dz has a power law behavior higher than minus 1, so if dy over dz, let's say, behaves like 1 over square root of z, then y minus would be finite. But if you plug that equation into the energy flux, you will see that energy flux will still be infinite. So mathematically, just is not physical. So from just mathematical point of view, you can see that y minus might be finite at the last ray, but the energy flux might be infinite from just the behavior of the equation, depending on the power law behavior. So yeah, in slide 15, you can see if you look at the MFA, the formula for MFA flux, there are these functional forms of dy over dz, where y minus is finite, but the flux is infinite at the last rate. So we may be in such a regime mathematically, but physically, personally, I don't know. There is this, there was this idea of a thunderbolt from Hawking, for example. Now, right now, we are trying to see. It's not only about, of course, the flux getting very high at the last ray, but they also claim that the singularity extends to infinity, etc., etc. We haven't strongly checked that. There is also the results of law previously, which say there isn't a thunderbolt. So we don't know whether this is related to that phenomenon or not for now. And I don't know physically what it corresponds to. I also had this idea that the flux would kind of reach a plateau and then would shut down at the last ray, but it doesn't. In short, yeah, physically, I don't really know why it's happening. Mathematically, we have some ideas, and it can be related to this thunderbolt phenomena. But it is one of the things we want to... That's why in my conclusions, I said one of the things to see is the behavior of the flux near last ray, whether it is infinite or finite, and if it is infinite, what do we say?
Okay, maybe I can just make a couple of additional comments as to physically what may be happening is the following. If you actually go all the way up to the last ray, then that last ray is coming, so to say, in... Okay, let me start from scratch. Okay, so look at the mean field approximation. In the mean field approximation, the singularity is not entirely resolved. There is still a singularity, a space-like singularity, and that singularity is, so to say, losing its strength, if you like, as you move towards the right in the Penrose diagrams, and at some point its area has gone to zero, the horizon area has gone to zero, and that is where the singularity meets it. But this singularity in the mean field approximation has been shown to be a weak singularity. In other words, the metric is continuous across there, but it's not C2. And because it is not C2, the scalar curvature actually does blow up there. Now, Fethi and Franz have been solving the equations in the mean field approximation. So in this approximation, there really is a singularity, and the last ray is coming from that singularity and going out all the way to infinity. And my suspicion is that indeed, just as the singularity was a weak singularity, there would be actually, in the mean-field approximation, a weak singularity, which is going to be, in other words, curvature might be infinite, but the metric itself would not be infinite. And this, again, the metric itself is well-behaved, is something that is borne out in the in the numerical plots that we have, the fact that y minus is finite and so on. And so the physical interpretation, as was given by Hawking et al. And by Susskind and other people, is really that the mean field approximation is, so to say, breaking down at this last, if you take it literally, reside on this last ray by itself. So in the real world, one would do this quantum calculation, and your expectation that the flux should switch off is indeed is what one would certainly expect. But it would happen, so to say, just starting from the last ray and going into the future of the last ray. Remember, there is still a body mass left over as we approach the last ray. This body mass per kind of channel, per scalar field, is only of the order of one Planck mass. But here we've got a large number of channels. And therefore, the body mass that is left over, typically, total one, is going to be in this simulation, is about 24 Planck masses, which is significant because one just began with about 500 Planck masses. 250 Planck masses. So it's maybe about 8% of the Planck masses that are still left over. 8-10% of the initial mass that might still be left over. And this mass still has to come out. And therefore, the flux is not going to be zero right at the last ray, but it's going to become zero to the future of the last ray. Now, that is something that we can really get a detailed handle on only if we know how to go beyond the mean field approximation.
Thank you.
More questions?
There's a question here.
Is this okay? One has to do with the definition of the mean field approximation energy flux. The question is this really what occurs on the right-hand side of the Bondi mass balance equation? So is this the corrected flux, or is it just the stress energy tensor expectation value?
The MFA flux I give in slide 22 is what appears on the right-hand side of the energy balance, the equation in slide 15. Yes, it's exactly what you have in slide 15. We basically stick to the definitions in the ATV paper.
When you're comparing it with the dashed line, that is the Hawking flux and the external field approximation, which is just the expectation value of the stress energy tensor. So I'm just wondering why the comparison is actually the correct one, because the Hawking constant flux is really calculated just using the expectation value of the stress energy without dropping any terms, or does it not make any difference?
No, I think it does make a difference, and I think the major gap between the two lines is probably because of this. And I think if we looked at, I think you're right, but I think at the zeroth level, what Fethi is saying, namely that there is actually a departure from the Hawking prediction for a sufficiently long amount of time, and towards the end, there is complete disagreement with the Hawking prediction. It's also true if one had actually plotted Ty minus minus, I think. I only done it by eye, by looking at the plots. I think it would be good to actually get a real plot from the numerics rather than, you know, my putting with a pencil and measuring with rulers and trying to draw a plot there. So, your point is completely well taken, but the qualitatively what Fethi is saying, that there is actually a disagreement between external field approximation and the mean field approximation, is also correct.
Thank you. And the second question, one is fairly sure from the simulations and all this beautiful work that Fethi and Sanford has done,
I have a hard time hearing.
Yeah, okay. So one seems to last ray, there is a finite Bondi mass which is left over. No matter how singular actually the MFA energy flux turns out to be, it will always have a finite integrated quantity. I mean, it will integrate out to some finite quantity. Is that an invariant conclusion I can take away?
Yes, because that the x-axis I have for the MFA energy flux is a compactified. The compactified coordinate, and the compactification is such that it emphasizes the region near the last ray. In fact, that region from 0.9 to 1 in the MFA energy flux plot is in fact very, very small. If you look at if you look at it in terms of, you know, the uncompactified z coordinate, so even though it's decreasing a lot, also the area where that increase occurs is exceeding the smaller and smaller. So its contribution is getting small and small. But we haven't, as I said, it's still something to be seen more definitively to see what happens exactly to the energy flux, what its behavior is near the last ray.
And the last also a small distance in y minus, or is it a large distance in y minus?
That's one thing. Yes, in z minus it's very small. In y minus, it's still small, but not very small. Near the last ray, the behavior between z minus and y minus is supposed to get close to a linear relation. It's not exactly linear, but it also depends on the behavior of the energy flux in a sense. Yes, in my y minus, it's not as small as it is in z minus. In y minus, it's not small but it's still smaller. Even compared to this compactified coordinate, it's smaller. But yes, y minus, because y minus is growing very fast as a function of z minus, it will be a larger region in y minus, and the integral should be over y minus, because in the energy balance, we have d over d minus of the map. But still, in y minus, it is not a very big region, but bigger than z minus.
Okay, and so the flux okay, thank you.
Hello?
The big thing that establishes the finite remnant of the mass, the mass being finite at the last ray, would be slide 23. It's not definitive proof, but you know that A exactly goes to zero at the last ray. And you can see that the ratio of area over mass is decreasing. So it's an indication that, and I don't show the full range here, in fact I can get much closer to zero in terms of y on slide 23. So area will go down to zero, but the ratio of area over mass will become left towards zero, even though it starts at one. So the mass will always, in a sense, will decrease less than the area near the last ray. And if you look at the remnant mass, you won't expect to lose all of it, even in that little gap region that we can't see between the end of our simulation and the last ray.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay. There's a question here from Alex Corici.
So my question is regarding the Planck scale black holes. So the question is, if one expects this mean field approximation to be reliable, especially since after what Abai was explaining at the end point of evaporation, so what happens with these Planck scale black holes? Should we trust also these results?
Okay, one thing is, we have never questioned the validity of the mean field approximation in our numerics. So we just take those two equations at mathematical formulas and numerically calculate them. In terms of numerics, yes, they are numerically very reliable. If those equations describe physics, this is what physics you have. But do those equations describe physics? Well, that I am not sure, I should say. Maybe Professor Ashtekar has some more ideas about that. But it may be a regime where the mean field approximation itself breaks down and the equations we are using aren't reliable. Do you have a comment on that? Professor Ashtekar?
Not anything definitive. I mean, there is no a priori reason to believe that the approximation is the meaningful approximation is a good thing to take. But again, looking at your plots, I mean, it does seem that the results seem to be sensible to me. Namely, that when you start with a mass which is less than the one Planck mass, so to say, M star, which is less than one Planck's mass, then at the end there is evaporation. But of course, you cannot have the remnant mass to be equal to one Planck mass because the initial mass was less than that. And your curves and so on seem to be, I mean, there's nothing erratic happening up there. Now, the question is whether, nonetheless, we should say that from the beginning, that meaningful approximation is not valid, and therefore we should just not do anything here. And I think that's not a good attitude. I think the good attitude is to say that, well, let's explore what happens. It does take, meaningful approximation does take, tell us this specific thing. Can we understand it? Is this what one might expect from a full quantum theory? And maybe one might say that no, this is not, or yes, there is not. But I think since the equations are meaningful, it is good to see what they are telling us and then decide whether those results should be taken seriously. And at this stage, I don't have a view one way or the other, but they seem to be making more sense than I might have a priori imagined.
Thank you.
More questions?
Just one more comment to Alex.
Can you speak up, please?
One more comment in response to Alex Corici's question, namely that presumably what one is doing is using the mean field approximation if one sticks to using it near null infinity, then I guess at least that part of it would be testable. Of course, once you go closer and closer, it would be large, but near null infinity, I think, you probably would be able to trust at least to some level the mean field approximation. That's the only comment I have. Thanks.
More questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.